Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Professor Alexander Nemirov for Outlandish Life, Peter Paul Rubens and the Baroque, exploring the dramatic art of the 17th century. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
That this is war, that these people were killing our people.
The uproar over a follow-up strike on an alleged drug boat in the Caribbean is not subsiding.
We'll hear from one of the senators who got a closed-door briefing this Thursday, December 4th, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ahead this hour, a corruption scandal in Ukraine is creating problems for President Zelensky.
But has it actually weakened him or Ukraine's aspirations to join the EU?
Historically, it is the thing that sort of distinguishes Ukraine from Russia, but it's also something that has a very sort of emotional appeal for a lot of Ukrainians.
Plus, we meet a Colorado cop who's hell-bent on making you laugh.
Vinny Montez says he's found an outlet that helps him cope with the stresses of the job, stand-up comedy.
The number one question I get asked when I get off stage is, are you really a cop? Because I've never met a funny cop.
First the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. Lawmakers received new details today about a September strike on survivors aboard an alleged drug boat in the Caribbean. The members saw video of the strike and questioned Navy Admiral Frank Bradley, the Special Operations Commander who oversaw the operation. NPR's Sam Greenglass reports.
The video was shown to the top Republicans and Democrats on the Intelligence and Armed Services Committees. Representative Jim Himes, the ranking Democrat on the Intelligence Committee, said the video of the strike showed two individuals on a largely destroyed vessel, which he says violates the laws of armed conflict.
What I saw in that room was one of the most troubling things I've seen in my time in public service.
Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Republican Tom Cotton said he did not believe the second strike was illegal.
I didn't see anything disturbing about it. What's disturbing to me is that millions of Americans have died from drugs being run to America by these cartels.
President Trump told reporters he would be willing to release video of the strike. Sam Greenglass, NPR News, Washington.
The Trump administration is reducing the validity of work permits for some immigrants. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran reports that as of tomorrow, work permits will only be valid for 18 months.
Work permits have been valid for 5 years, so this is a significant change. It applies to immigrants who have been admitted as refugees, have been granted asylum, or have been granted or have a pending withholding of deportation or removal. USCIS Director Joseph Edlow says the changes to the validity of work permits, quote, will ensure that those seeking to work in the United States do not threaten public safety or promote harmful anti-American ideologies. The announcement comes in response to the shooting of two National Guard members last week in Washington, D.C. One of them died. The alleged shooter is an Afghan national who was granted asylum in April. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News, Austin.
Democratic lawmakers are quizzing businesses that reportedly have made donations to President Trump's planned ballroom. NPR's Scott Horsley reports lawmakers want to know if the companies got anything in return from the government.
Lawmakers have written to more than half a dozen big companies, including Amazon, Microsoft, and Union Pacific Railroad, asking how much they donated to the ballroom and whether there was any discussion of a quid pro quo. All the companies that received letters have antitrust matters pending with the administration, which the lawmakers say raises questions about the possibility of influence peddling. J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon says his company chose not to make a donation to avoid the appearance of buying favors. So far, there's been little oversight of the giant White House ballroom or its price tag, which has grown to $300 million. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Google is out with its annual Year in Search list. This year's most searched terms include Charlie Kirk, K-pop Demon Hunters, and Labubu. Stocks close mixed today. This is NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. Bay Area advocates say immigration officials may be targeting members of the Afghan community after the Trump administration's recent freeze on asylum claims from Afghanistan. The Council on American Islamic Relations says at least a dozen people have been detained this week in Northern California. Joseph Azam is board chair of the Afghan American Foundation. He spoke on KQED's forum this morning.
I think our community has really struggled to do what it can to support family and friends in Afghanistan, working arm in arm with veterans and faith groups in the U.S., and to see all of that work now crumble and the effect of that crumbling be potentially people losing their lives and having families torn apart. I mean, that's absolutely an emergency.
The Bay Area is home to around 60,000 people of Afghan descent, one of the largest such communities in the country. San Francisco teachers have voted to authorize a strike after months of unresolved labor negotiations with the city's school district. The vote is the first of two needed before the United Educators of San Francisco can initiate a work stoppage over wages and health care coverage. Natalie Reese has the union's bargaining team. She says more than 99% of the members who voted approve the strike escalation.
We hope district management is, you know, really looking at where they're at in negotiations and preparing to bring us, you know, things that could be a potential agreement, because no one wants to strike, but we are willing to win the necessary things we're fighting for.
The district says it gave teachers large raises in 2023 and is currently working under state fiscal oversight as it heads off a massive budget deficit. I'm Natalia Navarro, KQED News.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for NPR comes from MS Now, home to The Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more. MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. And from the listeners of KQED. And support for KQED comes from Netflix, presenting The Perfect Neighbor, a documentary by Geeta Gandabir. Body cam footage bears witness to a tight-knit community navigating one neighbor's relentless harassment and the consequences of Florida's Stand Your Ground laws. Awards eligible.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The Trump administration's military campaign in the Caribbean has become a political firestorm and potentially a legal one. If you're not caught up, here's a quick rundown. On September 2nd, the U.S. military attacked a boat in the Caribbean it claims was carrying drugs. A second strike was ordered, killing two people who survived the first one. The officer who oversaw that strike is briefing lawmakers on Capitol Hill today. Now, President Trump and his team have repeatedly dismissed accusations of war crimes. It is clear they're aware of some kind of potential fallout, and they are working to contain it. For more on that, we turn to NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Hey there, Franco.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Hey, so Admiral Frank Bradley, this is the admiral who led the operation. He's the guy who's on the Hill today getting asked all kinds of questions about this. How does he fit into the picture?
Well, Bradley is the admiral who was named first by the press secretary in a carefully worded statement, by the way, and then by Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth as the one who specifically ordered that second strike that killed the survivors. And now he is the one, as you noted, the one facing scrutiny from lawmakers, and he's basically delivering just the latest version of how these strikes happened. And look, put aside questions about whether this is legal and whether this can be legally called a war at all, the administration has been putting out all kinds of different kinds of explanations about the strikes that have really just led to more confusion and legal uncertainty.
Right. I mean, we do know President Trump says he wasn't involved, wasn't aware. Pete Hegseth has said he was not in the room. What do we make of all of these shifts?
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes to the heart of what I expect, and we all expect, members of Congress are really drilling down on today, because it has caused so much confusion. Now, I spoke last night with Leon Panetta, the former chief of staff to Bill Clinton and defense secretary for Barack Obama, and he told me that in operations like this, the buck stops with the president and the defense secretary, but it is clear in this case, he says, that neither wants to take responsibility.
So what they're doing is basically trying to play whack-a-mole with the different theories in the hope that people will accept what I think is a distorted series of excuses that doesn't address just exactly what happened.
And Panetta says that when he was defense secretary, that they would have exhaustive meetings ahead of an operation like this to plan for any kind of contingency, including what to do if there are survivors.
Right. And whether something like that happened in this case is among the many things we don't know. Let me ask you, Franco, about consequences. How likely it is for either Secretary Hegseth or Admiral Bradley, how likely are they to face any kind of punishment, consequences, as more details come out?
Yeah, Trump was asked about that yesterday, and he didn't directly answer, but I think it does go back to the carefully written statement that the press secretary read earlier this week at a briefing that was kind of tacked on at the last minute, by the way. Huh. It was very choreographed. And I was speaking with Tevi Troy, who's a presidential historian and former White House aide to George W. Bush. He sees a clear effort to protect the president and the presidency.
When a press secretary who usually speaks off the cuff reads a very carefully written statement, it usually suggests that the lawyers were involved.
Now, Troy says Trump is likely to continue to support his cabinet secretary until he doesn't. And he's not going to protect Hexif, Trump, that is, if it is a detriment to himself.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez, thank you.
Thank you.
Democrat Jack Reed, ranking member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, launched the bipartisan Senate investigation into the strike off the coast of Venezuela. Admiral Frank Bradley, who leads U.S. Special Operations Command, recently briefed leadership behind closed doors. Senator Reed, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being here. So after a separate briefing today, Democratic Congressman Jim Himes called video that he saw of this episode deeply, deeply troubling. I'm quoting here. Did your committee also see that video?
We did see the video, and it was disturbing. As I said last night in a speech on the floor of the Senate, I believe the administration should release the entire video, what we saw, and also release numerous other reports so that there can be a factual discussion of what happened. Did it follow the law? Was it necessary and effective? All those questions have to be answered, and as I said last evening, the best way to start is to get the information to the public.
Understanding that this briefing was classified, is there anything else you can tell us about what you learned from Admiral Bradley?
Not really, because, again, we asked a series of questions. We were, I think, all of us, including my two colleagues in the House, Mike Rogers and Anna Smith, and my chairman, Roger Wicker, were all deeply engaged in questioning. We probed as much as we could, so much of it turns on legal opinions and legal judgments together with the facts of the situation on the ground. It was, I think, the beginning, I hope, of a fruitful discussion. I don't think we've reached the conclusion yet.
What questions do you still have after hearing from Admiral Bradley?
Well, the question I have is to what extent the Secretary of Defense influenced the operation, and that influence contributed to the outcome. Again, the Secretary was not shy about proclaiming after the fact publicly that we had destroyed a vessel containing cocaine and killing all personnel aboard the vessel. That should be probed, I think, to determine whether that was the overrode any other conditions or legal requirements.
Did you get a sense from Admiral Bradley's testimony whether Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth did give that kill them all order? Did that come up?
Well, again, that's a detail I think would be inappropriate because of the nature of the hearing.
I mean, I used to cover defense committees on Capitol Hill, and I know that the Armed Services Committees, they have a long history of bipartisanship. But that said, your Republican colleagues are facing a lot of pressure from President Trump in general. And specifically, he has been supportive of Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth in these actions. How confident are you, Senator, that your committee will be able to investigate thoroughly and that its conclusions will be taken seriously?
Well, I must commend Senator Wicker. We both asked for the hearing. We both have asked for all the materials that are still not being provided. We've tried to be collaborative, and we had. And he's, as you point out, under more pressure than most people in terms of raising these questions. And I think Chairman Rogers in the House and Adam Smith are both very committed. And they see their obligation to the country and also to the men and women of the armed services. I mean, one of the problems we have here is if we don't insist upon strict observation of the rules of law, we can't expect our opponents to do it. And as a result, we're jeopardizing the lives of young men and women in our armed services. And that has to be foremost in our deliberations.
You have now heard from the Admiral. You yourself graduated from West Point. You served as an Army Ranger. Where do you stand, taking stock of all of this? Was this strike a legal military operation?
Well, I have serious questions about the legality of all the strikes. The President has created a whole term of art, a terrorist denominated organization, et cetera, and that is no legislative standing. He is using the military in what has been a traditional law enforcement operation. The Coast Guard, which is a law enforcement agency, has conducted interdiction in the Caribbean for years and years and years. That's the proper way to do it. This is a departure from what has been traditionally seen as the best way to interdict narcotics coming into the United States. And so I have serious, serious questions about the overall legal validity of the operation and also individual operations, individual strikes.
And, Senator, I do want to ask you quickly, Secretary Hegseth has also been under scrutiny for sharing sensitive military operation over the free messaging app Signal, and I'll note that NPR CEO Catherine Marr chairs the Signal Foundation board. The Pentagon's inspector general concluded that the secretary violated Pentagon policies. Some of your Republican colleagues acknowledged that sharing classified information on this app was a problem. Will you call for Hegseth to be dismissed?
Well, I opposed his nomination, so I think I was a little bit ahead of my
And I understand that, but he was confirmed, so what should happen now?
Well, these are very serious charges. I don't think they're being treated by the administration as serious as they are. One of the conclusions in the report was that he jeopardized the life and safety of American pilots going into a combat action. That's something that no Secretary of Defense should do. So I think he has made a series of miscues that confirm my original judgment that he lacks the temperament, the experience, and the character to be Secretary of Defense.
Senator Jack Reed, Democrat from Rhode Island and ranking member on the Armed Services Committee, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'll note that in response to the IG report on the use of Signal, the White House has said no classified information was leaked and operational security was not compromised. And Secretary Hegseth has denied a Washington Post report that said he gave orders to kill everybody on the vessel that the U.S. bombed in the Caribbean in early September.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
A police officer who battled depression for years until he found an outlet doing stand-up comedy is ahead in the next segment of All Things Considered. Right now, let's get your traffic update starting in Hayward. Here's Julie Deppish.
A couple cars got into it on eastbound 92. It's before the 880 interchange. They do take up that right lane pretty slow back onto the San Mateo Bridge. We have a stalled school bus in Corte Madera, North 101 after Lucky Drive. That's partially blocking the HOV lane. It's a real crawl this afternoon back to Spencer Avenue. That motorcycle crash still there at Dublin Grade, eastbound 580 at Rao Ranch. Takes up the two left lanes and a major backup to the 238 interchange. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Julie will have another update in 10 minutes. Support for KQED comes from Second Harvest of Silicon Valley, providing nutritious food to one in six people in Santa Clara and San Mateo counties. Learn more at shfb.org. And from the San Francisco Symphony, where listeners can join the symphony to ring in the holidays with festive concerts throughout December. Learn more about their holiday programs at sfsymphony.org/holiday.
I'm Marisa Lagos on the next Political Breakdown. Every presidential administration has its own aesthetic style, but none in recent memory is as pronounced as the MAGA look, which has ushered in an era of plastic surgery and obvious fillers. We talked to Vox's Candace Grady about what femininity looks like in President Trump's administration. It's Political Breakdown on KQED News tonight at 6:30 or wherever you find your podcasts.
On the next Fresh Air, George Clooney. He became famous at 34. Late enough, he says, that he learned how to live before he learned how to be famous. His new character, Jay Kelly, wasn't so lucky. Clooney will talk about playing a movie star who has the fame part down, but the father, partner, friend part, not so much. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock. Support for NPR comes from MS Now, home to The Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more. MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org and from the listeners of KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highland Sacramento.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Ukraine is dealing with a massive corruption scandal at the same time it is engaged in high-stakes peace talks with the U.S. and Russia. The scandal has proven a challenge for President Volodymyr Zelensky. It's not clear, though, whether it has actually weakened him or weakened Ukraine's hopes of joining the European Union. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley brings us this report on how Ukrainians feel about this moment.
Operation Maidas dropped like a different kind of bombshell on Ukraine last month. The National Anti-Corruption Agency released this slickly produced five-part series on YouTube explaining its year-long investigation into fraud at Ukraine's state nuclear power giant Energoatom. Shocked Ukrainians tuned in as if to a Netflix drama, wiretapped conversations between officials with code names like Che Guevara and Sugar Man, who the agency said had siphoned off $100 million allocated for structures to protect energy facilities from Russian missile attacks. Opposition parliamentarian Ina Sovsun said she heard there was corruption in the energy sector, but had no idea it was so deep and systemic.
Was basically a whole system set up, not just some random bribes taking place.
Generators hum on the sidewalks across Kyiv, and people plan their lives around the scheduled rolling blackouts. The scandal stings even more because Ukrainians go hours without power as their energy grid is being damaged by constant attacks. Seven people are now under investigation, according to anti-corruption bureau NABU. President Volodymyr Zelensky himself has not been implicated, but last week Zelensky had to let his chief of staff, Andriy Yermak, go after investigators searched his home. Zelensky told the nation, "Nothing should distract us from defending Ukraine. Russia wants us to make mistakes. We will make none," he said. Lawmaker Sovsun says Ukrainians are frustrated, but they're still united behind Zelensky.
The government decided to fire two ministers who were involved in the scandal directly. Then the president decided to fire Yermak. Is that enough? Well, for the time being, it is, probably, while we are waiting for further details.
Ukrainians take fighting corruption seriously, says Yakub Parushensky, a geopolitical analyst with research center KI Insights.
Historically, it is the thing that sort of distinguishes Ukraine from Russia, but it's also something that has a very sort of emotional appeal for a lot of Ukrainians.
Emotional because of their hope to join the European Union. Over the summer, thousands of people came out in protest when the government tried to chip away at the independence of Ukraine's anti-corruption bureau. Young protesters saw Ukraine's future in the EU and understood reducing corruption is a key condition for getting in.
Hello.
Hello. Eleanor.
We visit the offices of anti-corruption agency NABU, where we speak to the star of the ominous videos, Detective Oleksandr Abakumov, who wears a big smile and a handcuffs pin on his lapel.
Everybody understands that Ukraine has chosen its European path. It's no longer a story about a corrupt country, but about a country that fights corruption.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Dmytro Kozyatynsky agrees. The 30-year-old former soldier says it was a shock when the Anti-Corruption Bureau's independence came under threat this summer. He joined the protests. He says the current investigation must go to the end.
In my opinion, the actual possibility of such operations to exist and to exist during the full-scale invasion, it shows that Ukrainian democracy is as strong as possible.
Operation Maidas, he says, could never take place in Russia. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kyiv.
First responders are often exposed to gruesome and traumatic events, and that puts them at higher risk of mental health struggles. That's what happened to Vinny Montez. As NPR's Lakshmi Singh reports, the police veteran spent years privately battling depression until he found a lifeline in the most unlikely of places, the comedy stage.
Most cops try to leave the job at the office when they're off duty, but Vinny Montez isn't your average cop. He's a stand-up comic.
Millennial cops are entering the police force.
Here he is doing a live show for the Dry Bar Comedy Special based in Provo, Utah.
There's a DUI report, and it was nothing but emojis. drunk emoji, get to the jail, poop emoji.
Montez is a burly guy. He shares bizarre tales on stage of working for the Boulder County Sheriff's Office in Colorado.
The number one question I get asked when I get off stage is, are you really a cop? Because I've never met a funny cop. And I love the fact that I can take a room and make everybody laugh and feel good. And my favorite comments, hey, I really had a really tough week, especially from somebody in the EMS field. And man, I needed to laugh.
Montez has spent nearly 30 years in law enforcement, most of that time as a deputy. Now he's the public information officer. On the job, Montez has responded to wildfires, shootings, and deadly accidents, and each time he did what other officers had done, moved on to the next crisis. Then, one night in 2008, there was a vehicle accident. There was a teenager, and despite Montez's desperate efforts, the teen died. Montez said he hit a breaking point.
I was going to dinner with my better half and sitting across from her and watching people have dinner and smiling, people I didn't know, but I was angry with them. I was mad. I'm like, why are you so happy? Because I was so miserable inside.
That's not uncommon. Police officers are at higher risk of experiencing mental health issues such as depression and post-traumatic stress disorder, according to a 2024 study. Another survey shows more than a third struggle with anxiety or panic attacks. And experts say even though there's more access to mental health resources today, the stigma around asking for help is still a powerful deterrent. Montez went to therapy, but he was looking for more, and he found comedy. Lawrence Miller, a police psychologist based in Boca Raton, Florida, says what Montez is doing makes perfect sense.
Humor relies on a sense of irony, which means that you're able to see an event from more than one perspective. And if someone has been in a traumatic experience, one of the perspectives they try to get is a way of distancing themselves emotionally from the trauma. And humor allows us to do that.
A lot of Montez's fans are other first responders. He says being on stage talking about some of the darker elements of the job helps them feel less alone. Of course, on stage, Montez rarely passes up a chance to poke fun at anyone who might have annoyed him when he was out on patrol, especially if they're outdoorsy, diehard loyalists of the Subaru.
Any Subaru drivers in here at night? Shut up, nobody cares.
Montez hopes to keep the jokes and the healing going when he shares the stage with other first responders in the national Heroes Off Duty comedy tour starting in January. Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
KQED News with Natalia Navarro is coming up after your traffic update, starting with the continuing trouble on the Dublin Grade. Here's Julie Depesh.
It is a major injury crash. A motorcycle involved on eastbound 580. It's at Rao Ranch. They have the two left lanes still blocked. An awful backup to the 238 interchange. A couple cars that collided Fairfield on eastbound 80 at Travis Boulevard. No lanes blocked. It's slow from Highway 12 east anyway. And new trouble San Rafael on South 101 before Lucas Valley Road. You've got an SUV and a car both on the shoulder. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction, custom home builders. Support for KQED comes from Rainbow Grocery Cooperative, a green business celebrating 50 years of offering organic, sustainable, and vegetarian options. Holiday shopping is available at 1745 Folsom Street, open daily 9 to 9. And from VisitorsCoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com. It's 5:30.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. California Senator Alex Padilla is helping to reintroduce a bill that would provide undocumented immigrants with a pathway to citizenship. That's as recipients of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, known as DREAMers, are getting caught up in the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. Padilla joined other lawmakers today to reintroduce the protections in the Senate.
So no. Trump administration, don't tell us that you're only going after the worst of the worst when you're going after hard-working dreamers that deserve better. Dreamers don't deserve to live in fear. Dreamers deserve to receive protection.
Dreamers are undocumented immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as minors and are legally protected from deportation. Employees with the West Contra Costa Unified School District began their strike today over demands for better wages and benefits. Teachers, along with young students and their parents, picketed on a crosswalk outside Madera Elementary in El Cerrito, chanting and waving homemade signs. Here's strike captain Mary Saltfeet, a teacher at the school.
We've been anticipating the strike, nervous for it, but also really ready to fight for our students and what our students need, and that includes keeping our teachers here, and by, you know, increasing our pay and getting better benefits, we're keeping teachers here who our students deserve, that stay for the long haul.
Several other Bay Area school districts seem poised to join them. San Francisco Unified School District teachers voted overwhelmingly in favor of a strike yesterday. San Francisco's new police chief, Derek Liu, says that growing the department's ranks will be one of his top priorities. KQED's Sydney Johnson reports.
Liu, who served the department for nearly 20 years, is stepping into the role of chief at a time when the city is struggling to recruit and retain officers.
Our officers right now, they're out there every single day. We're asking a lot of them. You know, having to work mandatory overtime, coming in on days when they're normally off. So getting them some relief is at top of mind.
SFPD has seen an increase in applications and academy graduates this year, but is still roughly 500 officers shy of its recommended staffing level of 2,000. But violent and property crime have both decreased citywide in recent years, despite the staffing challenges, and a new academy class begins this month. I'm Sydney Johnson, KQED News.
The Inspector General for California's massive prison system says a backlog of investigations into staff misconduct has ballooned to 10,000 cases. KQED's Julie Small reports.
The Allegation Investigation Unit is opening cases on staff misconduct faster than it's closing them. A new report finds that's adding an average of 650 cases a month to the backlog. The delays could mean many investigations could not be completed within a one-year statute of limitations, and officers could not be disciplined for misconduct. Prison officials are testing out ways to expedite investigations. I'm Julie Small, KQED News.
The Bay Area's professional women's soccer team, Bay FC, has a new head coach. The team announced today that Emma Coates will take over, pending visa approval. After wrapping up commitments with her current team, England's national under-23s. That's the development team for the powerhouse Lionesses. Coates replaces Albertine Montoya, who resigned at the close of the season after a league investigation into his coaching tactics, and also after Bay FC placed second to last in the standings. The investigation cleared him of bullying accusations. Coates said in a statement that she's honored to build on the team's foundation and bring a people-focused and exciting style of play to PayPal Park. I'm Natalia Navarro, KQED News.
Support comes from Postman, offering a platform to assist teams build APIs to help API agents make decisions. Postman.com. Support for KQED comes from Kaiser Permanente, where their doctors, hospitals, and health plans are designed to work together to help their members live healthy lives. Kaiser Permanente, a better idea for healthcare. Support for the KQED car donation program comes from local Kia dealers announcing the Season of New Traditions event going on now at local Kia dealers, offering a selection of SUVs, sedans, and hybrids. More info at Kia.com. It'll be mild and dry for the next 7 days in Northern California. Expect valley fog tonight with lows in the 40s. Your Friday afternoon will be sunny with highs in the 60s. And support for NPR comes from Focus Features, presenting Hamnet, directed by Chloe Zhao, starring Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal, now playing in select theaters everywhere December 5th. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals whose ideas, solutions, and discoveries expand people's expectations of what's possible, macfound.org, and from the listeners of KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highlands.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. 1 year ago today, the CEO of United Healthcare, the largest U.S. health insurer, was gunned down in New York City. The act of violence ignited a reckoning over the high cost of healthcare in this country. But 1 year later, things have only gotten worse. NPR financial correspondent Maria Aspen has been reporting on this and joins us now. Hi there.
Hi there.
So Maria, NPR has been reporting on the problems with U.S. healthcare all year. Just start by telling us, where are we now?
Well, from a consumer perspective, it's sobering how bad things have gotten. People just can't afford health insurance, no matter how they get it. We know the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare subsidies are set to expire at the end of the year, meaning some 22 million people could see their premiums skyrocket. Another 154 million people get insurance through their employers, and those premiums are also set to soar next year. Just to put it all in perspective, a recent Gallup poll found that almost half of all adults worry they won't be able to afford necessary health care next year.
Which I have to say is pretty sobering. Maria, you've also been digging into the businesses and investors that are making money from this health care system. What have you found?
They're also increasingly unhappy with it because they're making a lot less money. Take United Health Group. That's the massive company that owns United Healthcare and was the target of a lot of consumer anger last year. It is one of the most influential companies in the stock market, aside from tech companies, and its shares are down 45% from this time last year. I talked about this with Julie Utterback. She's an analyst who covers healthcare stocks for Morningstar, and she says that until 1 year ago, United Health had a pretty great reputation among investors.
The best run managed care organization, a safe place to put your money, and that basically got all blown up in 2025.
Now United Health has replaced its CEO, it's being investigated by the Department of Justice, and it's just making less money, mostly because the costs of things like drugs and visits to the doctor are rising, which is squeezing the margins for United Health and other insurance companies. United Health declined to comment for my reporting, but I should point out that the same financial problems have been hitting most other healthcare companies and their stock prices.
Given that health insurance premiums are going up so much, why should we care about the profits of businesses and investors?
Well, it shows how broken the system is. If even the people making money from healthcare aren't happy with it, does it work at all? Also, the fortunes of these healthcare companies matter to our broader economy. Healthcare spending is a fifth of our economy, and what happens with these companies affects what's going on in our broader markets. I talked about this with Catherine Hempstead. She's a policy officer at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and she's written a book about the insurance industry.
I think right now we're really going off the rails, and we're having, you know, lots and lots of problems in every segment of the business.
And problems with the businesses spill over to the rest of us.
So, Maria, what does this mean going forward for both businesses and consumers?
Well, that's where you do see a big difference between the business world and everybody else. If you talk to policy experts like Hempstead, they say that since the crisis is so deep and so far-ranging, maybe it'll lead to a much more radical change to this country's for-profit healthcare system.
Meanwhile, investors in health insurance companies say they're still a good long-term bet. Investors think the profits and share prices are eventually going to go back up after they get past the financial difficulties of these next few years. But for you and I, Juana, bottom line, don't expect healthcare to get more affordable anytime soon.
NPR's Maria Aspen, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, now to a mystery that has lingered for nearly 5 years and that may now be solved. The FBI says it has apprehended the man who placed pipe bombs near the U.S. Capitol the night before a mob stormed the building back in January 2021. Federal authorities took him into custody this morning in Virginia. FBI Director Kash Patel addressed reporters from the Justice Department.
Today, I'm proud to stand here before you and say, we solved it. He will have his day in court.
NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson is following the story. She's with us now. Hi, Carrie.
Hey there.
What do we know about this suspect?
His name is Brian Cole Jr. He's 30 years old and from Woodbridge, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C. Court papers say he works in the office of a bail bondsman. He's being charged with transporting an explosive device with intent to kill or injure and attempted malicious destruction. The Attorney General Pam Bondi says this investigation continues and the suspect may face more charges. The FBI is continuing to process evidence it gathered through search warrants and to conduct new interviews.
And Carrie, just remind us, because there was a lot going on that day and adjacent to that day, what are the details of the crime that they're charging him with?
There's grainy camera footage of someone wearing a hoodie and dark pants near the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee buildings nearly 5 years ago. Hours later, police found pipe bombs at those locations, diverting law enforcement attention from the mob that was swarming the U.S. Capitol. Those pipe bombs did not detonate, but the FBI says they were viable and they did pose a real threat to public safety. Deputy FBI Director Dan Bongino once called the pipe bombs a, quote, inside job when he worked as a podcaster. But today he got some credit from colleagues for helping bring this suspect to justice. Here's more from Bongino.
Folks, you're not going to walk into our capital city, put down two explosive devices, and walk off in the sunset.
Okay, so my question, how did they crack this? As we say, this all unfolded nearly 5 years ago. This was a cold case.
It was. The FBI had poured a lot of resources into this investigation, but they still came up short. New FBI leaders made it a big priority. They assigned new analysts and investigators, and those people came up with what they describe as a key forensic lead. An FBI affidavit says Cole purchased components that could have been used to make these pipe bombs. These are things like electrical wire, steel wool, battery connectors, and parts to close the end of a pipe. The court papers say a cell phone tied to Cole also pinged cell towers near the RNC and DNC the night the bombs were placed, and a license plate reader near the area captured his car, a Nissan Sentra, that night. Here's Attorney General Pam Bondi at the news conference.
Let me be clear. There was no new tip. There was no new witness. Just good, diligent police work and prosecutorial work.
Darren Cox, who leads the FBI's Washington field office, says the Bureau has a long memory and a long reach.
Okay, so where does this case go now?
The suspect, Brian Cole, will get his day in court, the opportunity to enter a plea. And there have been a lot of conspiracy theories swirling around this pipe bomb case for years now. There was a lot of pressure from President Trump's MAGA political base to solve this crime. It remains to be seen whether some of those people will be persuaded by the evidence the FBI has gathered. But FBI leaders today suggested they have even more evidence they haven't released. That's notable since FBI leaders this year have been criticized for talking too much about ongoing investigations. It's a reflection of how important this pipe bomb case is to them that they're being extra careful now.
That is NPR's Carrie Johnson. She covers the Justice Department. Thank you, Carrie.
My pleasure.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. In Hong Kong, a review committee is set to investigate the region's deadliest fire in a century. At least 21 people have been arrested so far as part of an investigation into substandard materials used to renovate the 7 apartment buildings that caught fire. So far, at least 159 people have been confirmed dead in the blaze, dozens still missing. NPR's Emily Fang reports.
Buddhist monks this week rang prayer bells to guide the souls of the people killed in the fire at the Wong Fuk Court Complex into the afterlife. Outside the serenity of this scene of grieving, however, is mounting public anger. Frustration that the blaze in Hong Kong's Tai Po district was perhaps preventable.
Yes, we have identified failures.
That's Hong Kong's chief executive, John Lee. He is facing heavy criticism for what he admits are systemic failures in housing regulation.
We need to ensure vested interests will not be allowed to be a factor to cause this tragedy.
But advocacy groups critical of Lee point out the review committee he's created would have no subpoena power. Already, a local anti-corruption body has arrested several people in connection with substandard renovation material. And one citizens' advocacy group twice sent emailed complaints that NPR has viewed to Hong Kong's Labor Department, complaining in July and October 2024 about flammable netting. Hong Kong's Labor Department did not respond to an NPR request for comment on the complaints.
They won't. No dissenting voices.
This is Michael Mo, a former local councillor from Hong Kong. He points to the case of one Hong Kong student collecting signatures for a petition demanding an independent inquiry who was already briefly detained. And in another case,
one of the civil society-led press conferences has been called off after the National Security Police pretty much summoned all these proposed speakers.
Summoned them in for a meeting. Asked on Tuesday about these detentions, Chief Executive John Lee responded,
"Well, criminals commit offense must be taken to justice."
Beijing's National Security Office in Hong Kong said on Wednesday, quote, "a small group of hostile external forces disrupted recovery efforts."
At the back of the minds of many people who asked this question is the result of the passing of the Hong Kong National Security Law of 2020 and the way how government in Hong Kong seems to be approaching the issue appears to have changed.
This is Stephen Tsang, director of the SOAS China Institute in London. He argues Hong Kong, under pressure from Beijing, is prioritizing managing dissent, not the causes of the tragedy itself.
The fire alarms in those buildings were not working properly to alert people, and we have not seen those questions being asked and addressed.
Samuel Chu, the president of the pro-democracy advocacy group Campaign for Hong Kong, says this diminishes popular trust.
And so I do think that people in Hong Kong now look at John Lee and the government and say that, you know what, I think the mainland office is calling the shots.
Meanwhile, police are warning the search for people still missing could take up to 3 weeks longer. The fire burned so hot and for so long that they say any human bodies left could have been reduced to ash. Emily Fang, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Stay tuned for the KQED News Quiz after your traffic update starting in Walnut Creek. Here's Julie Deppish.
It's southbound 680 before South Main Street, where 3 vehicles tangled up and the 2 middle lanes are blocked, starting to back up to the 24 interchange. Back to that bad motorcycle wreck coming off the Dublin Grade eastbound 580 after Rao Ranch. They still block the 2 left lanes, really bad backup there to 238. And according to Madera, we had the stalled school bus on North 101 after Lucky Drive. Just cleared that, but things are very delayed back to Rodeo Avenue. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Julie will have another update in 10 minutes. Traffic support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa at Yosemite. And support for KQED comes from Gardens of Golden Gate Park. Lightscape at San Francisco Botanical Garden opened November 21st. Visitors are invited to a luminous blend of art, sound, and nature that transforms the garden after dark. Tickets at gggp.org. And from Smuin's The Christmas Ballet, this joyful production features both classical ballet and contemporary numbers, with new additions premiering alongside audience favorites. Now through December 28th, tickets at smuinballet.org. And it's now time for the KQED News Quiz question of the day. And today's question is, on All Things Considered, Life Kit host Mariel Segarra explained smart tactics to handle what? Submit your answers at kqed.org/radio news quiz for a chance to enter to win.
Prices for so many things have been soaring, but not computers. They've been getting cheaper for decades. Is that going to last? Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition airs from 2 until 9 here on KQED News. And this week in KQED Science, meteor showers, a massive moon, and even a chance to see Jupiter at its most striking. We look ahead to this winter's astronomical events at kqed.org/science.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly, sitting here chatting with someone whose voice many of you may recognize. Hi, David.
Hey, Mary Louise. It's good to see you.
It's good to see you. It's been a while since I've seen you in a studio inside NPR headquarters.
It's been way too long. It's surreal to be here. It's really something.
All right, y'all are hearing David Green, who, as many of you will recall, did the same job I do now, 4 years, but in the morning, as host of Morning Edition. He has been up to all kinds of stuff since he stepped away from that post in, when was it?
Beginning of 2021.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So coming up on a few years now, and we have called him back to chat about his newest job, which is in local news. David is taking over LNP, that's his hometown paper, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. He is relaunching it as a nonprofit. He's hoping to build a model that other newspapers can build on. So, this is going, what, way back to your roots? You were an intern back in the day at LNP?
I was. I grew up in Lancaster. My mom taught at Franklin and Marshall College. We lived right across the street. We read the Sunday News, the New Era, and the Intelligencer Journal.
Do you remember your first, front page byline?
I don't remember my first front page. I remember one of my first stories. The editor sent me out at around 9 p.m. on a Saturday night to cover a barn fire in Amish country. And I was standing there with the owner of the barn and chatting. And he was like, very casually, I think we should step back. I was like, okay, I'm going to start moving backwards in the grass. The entire side of the barn comes crashing down in this like flames. I go back to the newsroom just covered in ash, thinking that there's going to be some level of sympathy. And Marv Adams, who was my editor at the time, and he looked at me and didn't say anything about the ash covering my body. He was just like, 6 inches?
It's like how many columns you get.
Yeah. That was it. Yeah. Just go write the story. Like, yeah, I'm not noticing this. My roots go back that far, and I care deeply about this paper and this community.
So this paper, to say you're walking into a challenge sounds like it's putting it mildly. What kind of shape was this newspaper in?
So about 2 years ago, the Steinman family that has been committed to local vibrant journalism for generations, they gifted the paper to WITF Pennon, which is, you know, one of our great public radio stations and public media companies. And this was supposed to be, you know, great for both organizations. And I've been working with obviously the leadership at Pennon WITF, and they've been amazing, I think, realizing that there have been a lot of lessons learned, that they were not in a good position to run a newspaper.
They were weighing options that I gather included complete restructuring
or bankruptcy.
Filing for bankruptcy.
Yeah. And the idea of LNP going bankrupt to me was just something I could not accept. I mean, you know as well as I do what is happening in this industry right now. I mean, we've lost 40% of our local newspapers over the past 20 years. There are 50 million Americans who are without reliable local news right now. And when you're losing your local news outlets, I mean, that's when we're all being driven into our echo chambers and not talking to each other as neighbors anymore. So I was, the idea of this happening in Lancaster, where I grew up, I couldn't accept it.
I am compelled to point out, you're an amazing journalist. I know this firsthand. You've done all kinds of things. You have made documentary films. You were NPR's White House correspondent. You were our Moscow correspondent. I filed with you from Moscow.
Yeah.
Have you ever run a newsroom? Like, have you ever led an all-staff meeting?
No, No. And I mean, I've been to a lot of all staff meetings like you.
So I
mean,
have
like,
I.
We have been to them together and you know what we do. We ask really hard questions of leadership. So yeah, the first all staff meeting, you know, we were in.
When was it?
It was a couple days ago. And it was really, it was a lot emotionally. I've never been on that side of things. Like I'm looking at people who are relying on me to sort of set the vision, to lead, but also relying on me for 401ks, health insurance. And so, you know, I was trying to give a message of, you know, reassuring that no, nothing is going to change immediately. And hope that they were ready to invest in this new nonprofit model and mission, which they largely seem to be, which is really cool because they've been through so much.
What's the vision? I mean, and it's particularly since you said you're taking the reins from a public media company.
Like, yeah.
What can you do that they couldn't?
In the simplest terms, it is a three-legged stool. Like the whole problem that has made the newspaper industry so damaged and so unsustainable is ad revenue, subscription revenue are just not supporting things enough to go on. That's why we're seeing so many newspapers close. If you add a philanthropic leg and just change the culture so people feel like, you know, this is ours. There are a lot of people and a lot of smart people in our industry who have thought about ways to funnel philanthropic money into local news organizations. And I just felt like all the ingredients to pull this off are there in Lancaster. So let's do it.
I read LNP's own story. It did quote two local Republican officials who sound skeptical. One of them said, the current values of the editor at the paper are at odds with the community they serve.
Yeah.
How do you go about rebuilding trust that sounds like has been damaged?
That is, if there's one thing keeping me up at night right now, it's that. Because our entire industry is, I mean, we are facing an existential crisis. I don't have to tell you that in these political times. I am embracing this. Those lawmakers and local officials who said those things, they also said, you know, they're willing to give David Green and his new team a chance. I can't wait to talk to them. There's also concern I've already heard from the community who have said, like, what does David mean by rebuilding trust? Does that mean that it's just going to be, you know, pumping out Republican talking points to get people back from the right trusting the media? That's not what it's going to be. I think what it is going to be is being transparent about who we are. I've encouraged the entire staff, reporters, everyone else to be out in the community, to remember that we're all neighbors. I mean, to talk about the work we're doing, to be listeners. We're going to start a community advisory panel, bringing people in and saying, you know, what do you want to talk about? What do you think we should be covering? What's important to you? And this is what I feel like I'm in this fight, Mary Louise, not just for Lancaster, and that's where the priority is, but like for you and me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because the trust has to be rebuilt closer to home. Like, that's where people are going to remember, like, oh, I disagree with my neighbor, but like, we go to PTA meetings together, we go to church together, we go hunting together. So like, why can't we actually talk about stuff together? And the role that I think LNP can play in being a hub for that kind of civil discourse and civic engagement, that's when we're going to be pulling something off the special.
Because if people trust their local newspaper, news outlet, then maybe it increases the chances that they trust what people are doing on the national, international
exactly.
level. And that link's been broken.
The work is important, and they're going to be listening to you and me and, you know, in our shows and trust us again, too. But the work has to start, I think, closer to home.
David Green, my former NPR colleague, now, what's your new title? Interim Publisher.
Interim Publisher.
Of LNP in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
You got it.
Thanks, David.
Thanks, Mary Louise.
Good luck.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals whose ideas, solutions, and discoveries expand people's expectations of what's possible, macfound.org. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents, and from the listeners of KQED. Well, a federal advisory committee is set to remove the recommendation that all babies get vaccinated against hepatitis B at birth. A preview of tomorrow's vote is coming up after the newscasts and after KQED traffic, starting with an update on that motorcycle crash on the Dublin Grade. Here's Julie Deppish.
I've been dealing with that since the 4 o'clock hour, eastbound 580 at Rao Ranch Road. They still have those two left lanes taken away and a very tough backup to the 238 interchange. New wreck on the peninsula, San Mateo on South 101 before Highway 92. That's in the middle lane, second lane for the left. A San Jose crash southbound Highway 17 after the 280 interchange. That's in the left lane, very slow from Stevens Creek. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from East Bay SPCA, proud to connect Bay Area pets and people so they can share the love this holiday season and help save lives. For more information, visit eastbayspca.org. I'm Michelle Hennig.